This is Simon Shaheen. You are listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM.
This is Mitch McConnell when I'm up in the Catskills to go hunt bear and visit my friends in the Greene County Legislature. I always tune into WGXC. I love that weird show, the Nothing Is Real Radio Hour, but it's not on very often. What a bunch of crazy Yankees up there. Where is that station again? Hell, now, remember, it's at 90.7 FM on the dial in my Lexus. I wish we had something like that in Kentucky. Don't forget to vote, y'all.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Roman Horst of Germantown, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by Time and Space Limited, TSL, in Hudson, New York. Expanding minds since 1973. TSL is an art house for documentary, independent, and classic movies, a gallery for art exhibitions, a space for performance, a store for used books, and much more. More information at timeandspace.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Wednesday, March 12th. Local early morning temperatures range from 27 degrees in Tannersville to 35 in Kinderhook. Regional average soil temperature is 34 degrees. Unless we get a nasty cold snap, this could be the start of the takeoff. I find that soil and river temperatures tend to govern the spring conditions around here. Today starts dry and ends messy. We get a high of 47 at 3 p.m. Around 5 p.m. or so, rain is expected to enter the area. It should turn to snow around 9 p.m. and temperatures fall to 34 degrees overnight. Snow should end by sun up on Thursday. Any accumulation should melt due to warming soil and a high temperature of 48. Overnight, we hit 34 degrees. Friday will be nice, dry, with a high of 56 at 5 p.m. Overnight, temperatures dip to 43 degrees. Then Saturday might have a rainy afternoon and a high of 56. Sunset today will be at 6:43 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:09 a.m. I did a little bit of investigative work recently, and it's related. So, what I found was the electricity tariffs, if put back in place by Canada, will affect us. Central Hudson purchases from a wholesale pool, and some of that does come from Canada, and therefore would raise local prices likely between 10 and 20%. Okay, getting back to normal. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 5%. Plasma winds will be average at 457 kilometers per second with a thin density of 2 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently max standard with an S3 level noise floor. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 128. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
The Public News Service Wednesday afternoon update. I'm Mike Clifford. The Department of Education announced today it was firing more than 1,300 workers, effectively gutting the agency that manages federal loans for colleges, tracks student achievement, and enforces civil rights laws in schools. That for the New York Times. They report the layoffs mean that the department, which started the year with just over 4,000 employees, will now have a workforce of about half that size, that after less than 2 months of President Trump in office. The Times notes the cuts could portend an additional move by Trump to essentially dismantle the department, as he said he wants to do, even though it cannot be closed without the approval of Congress. And backers of legislation in Nevada say it would bring more balance to landlord-tenant relationships and ensure that rental homes are safe to live in.
Assemblymember Venetia Considine says for far too long, some Nevada renters have put up with unacceptable living conditions, from black mold to infestations and other issues that can go months without repair. She says Assembly Bill 223 is about strengthening tenant rights by giving them certain tools tools, like a process to file official complaints and the ability to exit leases at no cost if landlords drag their feet.
A verified complaint would give tenants the ability, if they've gone through the habitability issue, the 2 weeks time frame, still the lack of anything being fixed that is promised in a lease to be there that they're paying for, that they have a way to access the court without putting themselves in jeopardy of eviction.
Considine says there were thousands of statewide evictions in Nevada last year, but it's unknown how many were due to habitability issues because the current system doesn't track that information. I'm Alex Gonzalez reporting.
Next up, Oregon conservation groups are headed to the state capitol for Wildlife Lobby Day.
Srishti Kamal of the Western Environmental Law Center highlights the 1% for Wildlife bill, which would raise the state transient lodging tax by 1% up to 2.5%. Funds would help the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife implement the state wildlife action plan to protect imperiled species and habitats. Kamal says the plan currently has no funding from the state.
Even though we have a Democratic majority in our legislature this session, unfortunately, wildlife falls at the bottom of everyone's priority list.
One bill would help landowners use non-lethal tools to share land with beavers. I'm Isabel Charlet.
Meantime, an improvisational street dancer from small town Iowa is using his art form to interpret his world and express his identity, including defiance, rebellion, and even frustration with other artists. Chuy Renteria started breakdancing when he was 14 in West Liberty, Iowa, now nearly 40, and a father and a husband. He draws on what he learned.
Growing up in West Liberty, I felt too Mexican for the white people and too white for the Mexican people. It transcended all of that, right? Because you dance and then you found other people who also dance and it didn't matter.
Renteria says his latest expression, called fight dancing, allows artists to have the equivalent of a heated exchange on the dance floor rather than taking the anger into the street. This is Public News Service. Next to Montana, where the governor's proposed budget includes cuts to funding for senior long-term care.
Within the last 3 years, 11 of Montana's nursing homes closed in a single 12-month period. That adds pressure to those providers left, like Big Sky Senior Services in Billings, which provides payee services for over 100 people and offers in-home care for seniors on a sliding fee scale. Executive Director Tyler Anmanson says keeping seniors in their homes as long as possible is the goal, but there's usually a point where outside care becomes necessary.
And then they're in crisis because we don't have enough places to send them, or the places that are available to send them aren't getting funded well, and so the quality of care is going down.
Amundsen adds that reimbursement rates are not keeping up with the rise of inflation. Governor Greg Gianforte has proposed $50 million in cuts over the next biennium to senior and long-term care services via the Department of Public Health and Human Services. That's nearly 6%. I'm Kathleen Shannon.
Next to North Dakota, where the Senate's turned to ramp up debate on property tax reform, a key issue of the session.
Several bills to establish property tax relief have already cleared the North Dakota House. Yesterday, a Senate committee took up certain proposals. All the measures have different language, but a consistent provision calls for an annual 3% cap on property tax hikes sought by local governments. Perel Grossman with the North Dakota Soybean Growers Association told lawmakers he hopes the final package will include agricultural properties.
Some of these landowners might certainly have significant land, and others just might be facing huge debt because of their machinery, livestock costs.
Advocates also acknowledge the need for balance so that small and large communities aren't hamstrung in maintaining key infrastructure. Some rural municipal leaders worry about proposed caps limiting their ability to raise enough revenue, harming vital services. I'm Mike Moen.
Finally, Indiana lawmakers paused action this week on a bill which aims to prevent crashes caused by dangerously overgrown rural intersections.
The bill originated after 17-year-old Riley Settergren died in a 2017 collision at a Hancock County intersection. His father, Jay Settergren, testified Monday before lawmakers, urging stronger rules to prevent similar tragedies.
Just days before his senior year, Riley was taken from us by a piece of farm machinery that could not see at an intersection because it was obstructed by corn. They had to move out further into the road. The truck Riley was a passenger in was struck. Riley was killed instantly.
The current proposal would mandate property owners or renters near rural intersections clear all vegetation or obstacles above 3 feet, ensuring drivers can see approaching traffic. I'm Joe O'Leary, Public News Service.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Here's some radio stations, big and small, your favorite podcast platform. Find our content and trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Exploring Science in the Sea. The parrotfish is like a house cleaner who does a great job of keeping things tidy, but sometimes breaks a glass. You want to keep them around, but you just wish they'd be a little less destructive. For the parrotfish, the houses are coral reefs. They clean tiny organisms off the coral, keeping the coral healthy. But they also chip off pieces of the coral. If they chip away too much, they can damage the coral. Parrotfish have strong teeth. They grind up the coral they chip off, then poop it out as grains that can wash up on the beach as white sand. The scraping can scar the hard coral, the skeleton created by the living organisms inside, known as polyps. In many cases, the coral heals as new polyps move in. But in others, the coral can collapse. And if too many corals are destroyed, an entire reef can suffer. Researchers spent a decade studying the coral-parrotfish relationship in four regions of the Caribbean Sea. They looked at individual corals, complete reefs, and wider areas that encompass many reefs. They also studied the parrotfish populations. They found that more parrotfish generally meant more damage to the corals, but not always. Parrotfish prefer some species of corals over others. So in regions where those species weren't as common, or where there was less variety of coral species, the damage was less severe. The results may help managers control the parrotfish catch, perhaps improving the health of coral reefs across the Caribbean. Science in the Sea is a production of the University of Texas Marine Science Institute and is on the web at scienceandthesea.org. I'm Holly Brawley.
About the Campbell. Did it? Campbell appeared. Hitting him.
Hello there. Is that Eddie?
Oh, hello. Who's that, Professor?
Yeah, man. What's happening there in England?
Oh, damn good to hear you, Helby. Nothing at all, save a boring bloody music on the radio. And you know how one loves one's black music.
I mean, they're playing the same thing that they were playing five years ago.
Same old thing, dear fellow.
Oh, shit. What, so you ain't got no choice on the radio.
Well, no choice is no bloody choice, you know? So, El, what are you doing at the moment yourself, old fella?
I've got some new stuff, man. I wanna bring it out. I wanna get it played over there. I think the people ought to hear it, you know?
What is it like? What is it exactly?
Well, you could call it what you like. I don't have a name for it, but it sounds something like this. Have a listen.
This is Meredith Cooey, Wave Farm Radio Director. Coming up this week are two events featuring Tara Rogers, who records as Analog Tara. On Thursday, March 13th at 4 p.m. at Bard, Analog Tara is giving a talk and premiering work from her forthcoming album, Life of the Mother. And on Friday, March 14th at 6 p.m. at MPAC, she's giving a retrospective concert, pulling from the past 20 years of her body of work. Tara Rogers is a multi-instrumentalist composer, sound engineer, and historian of electronic music. She's the author of the 2010 volume Pink Noises, Women on Electronic Music and Sound, and has written numerous essays on the history of sound and synthesizers. Her research and music explore electronic sound as material and metaphor, with studio practice as a hands-on parallel to study of the long history of electronic music and sound. I sat down with Tara over Zoom on Monday, March 10th, to talk about her project Pink Noises, where we're at now when it comes to gender, politics, and electronic music, and her upcoming events. Can you tell me and our listeners just a little bit about yourself, what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview. It's great to speak with you and to reach your listeners as well. So I am a lifelong music maker, a multi-instrumentalist composer, sound engineer, and historian of electronic music and sound. As a composer and sound artist, I work in a wide range of genres and techniques, including beat-based genres like techno music and ambient electronic music as well, electroacoustic music composition incorporating piano improvisation and field recordings and other things. I also worked in the programming environment Super Collider for many years, creating some sound and multimedia installations, including data sonification pieces. So I'm looking forward to presenting a couple of programs in the area at Bard. On Thursday afternoon, I'll be presenting selections from a new album forthcoming this spring. And then at RPI, on Friday, I'll be presenting a retrospective concert, pulling highlights of my catalog over the past 20 years. So really looking forward to that very much. I'm actually originally from Rensselaer, so it's just really moving for me to be coming back home to present these programs. It's actually my first time, almost my first time presenting in the area. I think one of my bands in college came back and played a show at a cafe in downtown Albany many years ago, but for my electronic music self, this is really my first time presenting music back home, so it means a lot.
That's so interesting, because one of the questions that I was thinking about asking is, you know, within the span of 2 days, it's the premiere of new work, mm-hmm. and then a looking back at old work. And then the other question that I was about to ask was, how did you get your start? So it's this interesting mm-hmm. sort of like mm-hmm. spiral return. Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe starting with how you got your start and then working our way to the return, which I think could be fun. So yeah, in your book, the 2010 Pink Noises, Women on Electronic Music and Sound, you talk a bit about, you know, how you got your start. and this family mm-hmm. history of, mm-hmm. you know, music and then also telegraphy and radio technologies and, mm-hmm. and things. And so I was curious about, other than family lineage, what really drew you to electronic music and synthesizers? Like, what pulled you in?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think when you talk about how I got my start, it's like, how far back do we want to go, right? Because I, you know, I have this photograph of myself with a piano when I was maybe 16 months old, and I thought that was like the first evidence of my being drawn into the field of music. But recently, we had some family Super 8s converted, and it was actually before then, I think maybe at about 14 months, that I was reaching for the piano. We had an acoustic guitar in the room. I was reaching for that at the same time. So I'm one of these people who just really, you know, from the start, music just felt like such a natural mode of expression for me, even more so than language. You know, the writing about music has been like a secondary layer for me. It's definitely expression through music and sound that has always felt primary in ways that sometimes I can't even explain. And then for electronic music specifically, I think it was, it was in college that I got my first synthesizer, playing in a funk band, and it was actually a lucky find. I just happened to get a Roland HS60, which is like one of the Juno synthesizers, now very sought after, but really was looking to get it for its somewhat realistic organ sounds as we were playing, you know, 70s funk and soul covers. And then I discovered that, of course, the synthesizer could do all these other things as well. So that was kind of my first way in that sense. But also, you mentioned the stories I tell in the intro to the Pink Noises book, which is that, you know, at home, you know, music was always playing. Both my parents were fans and practitioners of music in their own way. My mom was a classically trained pianist, and my dad was a jazz and hi-fi audio fan, and so I had access to music playing in the house all the time, and also access to the technologies, particularly through my dad's interests, you know, through early personal computers that he would bring home from the school where he taught in the 1980s, to hi-fi audio equipment. And so I also learned to play music by ear. I didn't really take lessons in a formal way. I never wanted to do that. I always really liked learning by listening through technologies, you know, through whatever, you know, cassette deck or, you know, rewinding, listening to the radio, actually making recordings off the radio. So I was doing that from a young age. And then I think everything sort of came together, you know, after college when I was pursuing a music career in New York. I initially started playing piano in solo piano in cocktail lounges. So I had grew up immersed in this jazz piano tradition, actually very much in Albany and Schenectady, at clubs like the Van Dyke in Schenectady, where I would go as a kid, you know, to listen to my dad's favorite pianists. So I was kind of doing my best to follow along in that lineage. But, you know, the jazz scene in New York at that time, at least, as a woman and an instrumentalist, it felt hard to find my way. There were certain baked in assumptions there. You know, if you weren't a vocalist, I felt like audiences were very receptive, but it was more like the ways you had to navigate venues and booking managers and so forth. I kind of just happened into discovering electronic music around that time, and it felt comparatively more open as a field to just pursue different aesthetics, a little bit more free of genre constraints, and then, you know, I think a little bit more free to sort of carve out a space for myself, you know, professionally. So just started at that point and took it from there.
Thank you. two questions. I'll start with one from the book and gender, actually. You know, the book came out 15 years ago, and I'm wondering where are we at now? Like, where is that project at now? I see, like, some of, you know, it's like in archives and, but what do you see happening? I mean, in today, the world is extremely contentious as well. I mean, it's not that it never has been, right? So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, even just everything, so much feels like it's changing over the past, you know, 6 weeks, you know, since the recent administration came into office. You know, even if you had asked me this question a year ago, it might have been different. I mean, I think in terms of where, you know, where the Pink Noises project is at, you know, for me, that is a project that, you know, had kind of different chapters of its own life, right? It started as a website back in 2000, which was, it's hard to even imagine this time now, but it was before, you know, before the major social networks launched. So the website was really kind of like a, almost like a proto social network or a proto social network page, right? A way to find people with similar interests and connect them. You know, the site was really for everyone, but really placing a spotlight on work that had been done or that was being done by women at that time, people identifying as women at that time. And so it was about sharing technical information about music production, really about creating a space for learning that was open and accessible, as well as, you know, through interviews, documenting people's creative practices. So the site was live for about, I want to say 5 years or so, and actively updated for a few of those years. And then the book, you know, happened after that and kind of took shape out of the website, you know, with longer form interviews, reusing, I think, in a couple cases, content that had been on the website, but also extending on it. And, you know, the book also I thought of as a media activist project in a different way. It was, you know, the fact that it was a book to me meant that we could place it in libraries, in academic libraries, ideally to get on course syllabi, and change the way histories of electronic music and experimental sound work are taught. And it's been, you know, just always exceeding my expectations in terms of how it's managed to do that and find its way in the world now. And I would say, you know, at this point, it's just been a real pleasure to see, number one, how peer projects have endured. You know, for one great example, Female Pressure, started by Electric Indigo, the artist in Austria, and AGF, an artist who was interviewed in Pink Noises, Antje Gray, another co-founder or conspirator in that initiative. Female Pressure continues as a wonderful network, international network of practitioners in the field. And then to see so many proliferating other projects, you know, created by the generations that have come after, you know, that are tactically trying to solve similar issues or try to make their own, you know, culture you know, that moves things forward. So that's been really great to see.
I was listening to this talk that you gave at MuTech in 2018. Mm-hmm. What does field transformation sound like? And a couple of things you said jumped out at me, like creative expression is the embodiment of freedom. And creative expression embodies many different dreams or yearnings that move in the direction of freedom. I like noted those down. And you know, what you're saying about, for you, music is like more accessible to you than like, say, language. And then this feminist project of creating in electronic music, and then thinking about where we are now with gender in music. And so in the midst of this political climate with creative expression moving towards freedom, what is the possibility now? I know that's, you know, like what do these, like what is specific about electronic music that might lend itself to this like freedom of creative expression?
Yeah, that's a great and difficult question, right? I think, you know, I'm really paying attention in this moment to a politics of community-based work and mutual aid as a model. You know, one thing that interests me about electronic and experimental music, right, is that it is so often happening outside of, well, maybe not fully outside of capitalist means of control, but there's, you know, there's a lot of work happening in independent venues, right? Independent labels. You know, locally here in DC, we have Rhizome DC, which is a wonderful community-based venue that has, you know, experimental music programs alongside, you know, other events, you know, bubbling up from the community to address local needs, including, you know, political organizing and consciousness raising and so forth. So I think while it's not, while there isn't like an automatic relationship between electronic music and these sort of experimental venues or radical politics, I think there is often like a natural alignment there where artists who are working, you know, outside of traditional genre boundaries are also, you know, seeking community with others who are, you know, who are trying to do things in a different way. And, you know, even tying back to the, you know, the visit to RPI, you know, one of my points of connection there is that I studied with Pauline Oliveros when I was in the MFA program at Mills College. And Pauline, of course, her work lives on in part through the Center for Deep Listening at RPI. And, you know, a lot of Pauline's philosophy of deep listening was about, you know, attending to each other and attending to the environment and trying to build, you know, a better world through the ways that we train ourselves to listen and to engage, you know, with people and with the world around us. And so that kind of radical spirit and radical imagination, you know, is foundational, I think, to a lot of electronic and experimental music, and certainly that which I hold dear. I'm thinking of the scholar Barry Shank has a wonderful book called The Political Force of Musical Beauty. And that's been a touchstone for me in some of my recent work, which actually some of the music I'll be presenting on both of these programs coming up. I've been really interested in recent years in making music that can be felt and making these atmospheres of feeling that create a kind of, you know, a temporary place in the performance space for people to inhabit. And one thing that Shank writes about is this notion that, you know, being with others and experiencing music in a shared space like that, experiencing feeling together, right, is at the roots of, you know, of political affinity, or can be as well. You know, there's a kind of hopefulness in that.
do have a couple events coming up this week. Mm-hmm. The talk and premiere at Bard on Thursday, and then the retrospective concert on Friday. And I'm super curious about the new work, Life of the Mother,
mm-hmm.
which is going to be at Bard. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about that and what attendees are going to experience.
Mm, sure, I'd be glad to. So, I will present a short artist talk, I think, to introduce the work and talk in more detail about some of the methods for making that album. It's taken a while. I want to say it's been a few years that I've been fussing with this album, which is not not unlike me. I can fuss with things for a while before being ready to release them into the world. But this album, it's mostly made from analog synths, driven by this little hardware sequencer called the Zillion, which generates. Spits out a lot of different algorithms, and you can tune them in different ways. It's actually modeled after the Triad X Muse, which is the sequencer that Marianne Amiche used back in the, I think it was the 70s or 80s. So also a nice connection to the Bard and Kingston area to be to have this album kind of coming from that same instrumental lineage. It's a lot of like algorithmically generated stuff, as well as control voltage generated stuff through modular synthesizers, and it's layers upon layers of sort of dense processes. And I was working with this method that's new to me of essentially using a DJ mixer to mix these various sound sources together, especially like in blending like noise textures together with rhythmic textures, and trying to find that boundary between, you know, when I'm moving the crossfader, at what point does it cross over into noise versus something that's more discernible as rhythm or form. So that was really kind of the creative project for me in the course of making this album. And then at a certain point, I started reflecting on that phrase, life of the mother, right? It's one of these phrases. I pay attention to language in the news, and, you know, in the months since then, it might be a phrase like the price of eggs, right? Like these phrases that sort of surface everywhere, and all of a sudden they're just, you know, everywhere in the culture. And I was reflecting on that phrase in isolation, life of the mother, obviously in the context of post-Roe America, and reproductive health, reproductive rights, but treating that phrase in isolation, it's a phrase that to me holds enormous power and complexity, that it can refer to many different things beyond just what it signifies in debates over reproductive health. So I decided to give the album that name, but also to keep some of those concepts in mind, you know, that sort of strength and power, at the root of the sonic expression as well. So it's an album that really, I think, embodies a lot of complexity in these layers of processes, and kind of ranges back and forth between, you know, ambience and more beat-driven sounds.
So a new work at Bard, and then the next day is the retrospective concert at MPAC. And yeah, so coming back to where we were at the beginning of the conversation with this circling around, how does that feel to do that? The new and the looking back, kind of back to back.
Yeah, it feels wonderful, honestly, because it's almost like I'm getting this getting all this stuff out of my system and can move forward to a new project right after. Like, yeah, it definitely feels freeing both to present the album that I've been focused on for the last few years, and then also certainly to have this opportunity to present a program with work from different genres and projects over the years. Yeah, I've never actually presented, for the retrospective, I've never presented a program with so much of my work, you know, from different times and places together. So I've certainly been interested to listen to it together and hear, you know, hear patterns or habits, you know, that I hadn't noticed before. It'll be interesting to share that with the audience for sure. And hear, you know, people's reactions and input, after. And, yeah, definitely a treat to get to work with the MPAC staff and present in a 4.1 immersive sound system. Looking forward to that aspect of it as well.
And what has that process been like, bringing all of these things together and listening and re-listening?
Yeah, initially it was hard to narrow it down to 50 minutes or so. I've kind of lost track of how many albums I've made over the years. It's, I don't know, 7 or 8 or 10, or I guess it depends on what counts as an album. And then, you know, I have a lot more stuff on my hard drive, like outtakes and different extracts of things, that I was debating whether to sort of go down that rabbit hole as well. But yeah, I ended up leaning toward, you know, just trying to bring together some representative works. You know, there's some pieces that, I want to call them personal favorites, although I don't know that I would go that far. You know, like any artist, I'm probably pretty critical of anything that I do. So, but there's a couple of pieces that I think turned out, you know, okay in terms of what I was trying to achieve, that I wanted to include. And then a couple other pieces that were more like one-offs that might represent a particular concept or technique. For example, Butterfly Effects, that was the piece that I completed for my MFA at Mills. That was a long and complex project that basically tried to model butterfly interactions and behaviors in the form of a computer music composition, so that like individual sounds are generated in real time and interact with each other and change each other, transform each other, you know, are changed by sounds that represent ecosystem aspects, like, you know, weather events and storms and that kind of thing. So it's almost like creating a virtual world inside a piece of computer music. So there's only a small segment of that on the program, but because of you know, its kind of unique place within my catalog, I wanted to include that piece. So, and there's a few others like that as well. Other than that, you know, just trying to give it some sort of sense and structure, you know, I was debating whether to turn it into more like a mix or a remix, where I would, you know, make some additions to the works now to sort of tie it together more. But I ended up not doing that. I'm leaving it as leaving the works, you know, in their original state and just, you know, juxtaposing segments of them.
Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about these upcoming performances and concerts and anything about your hopes and dreams for this work?
I would love for folks to come out and listen and experience the music. It's always a treat to get to share music in different places, and certainly, as I mentioned, you know, to be back in my home region. Would love to connect with folks and I hope to create a magical experience of sound in these spaces, you know, together with the hosts and the technical staff at MPAC, you know, is working hard to support me on this as well. So I'm really looking forward to both programs.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Of course. Thank you.
This has been Meredith Cooey, and you just heard from the multi-instrumentalist composer, sound engineer, and historian of electronic music, Tara Rogers, also known as Analog Tara. Tara is performing and speaking this week at Bard on Thursday, March 13th, and at MPAC on Friday, March 14th. More information can be found on WGXC's community calendar at wgxc.org.
You know, I was listening to the radio, and I heard this thing!
90.7 FM, listener-aided and abetted radio.
This is the Greenville Cub Scouts, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGSC, Akron, Catskill, and Hudson.
Very good. Well,
meow.
We recommend this station.
We'll be right back.
one will die, but we don't have to make it ugly. We can burn bright, explode and shatter. We can burn bright, explode and shatter, and shatter.
Tell me. At the corner of my eye, I'm at a loss. This marijuana got me feeling fucked up.